from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in a new idea about autism, perhaps a new way of thinking that starts with the question. People with Asperger's syndrome in particular are often stereotyped as being maybe distant or cold to other people. What if what looks like coldness to the outside world is a response to being potentially overwhelmed by emotion? What if it's defined not by a lack of empathy, but an excess of empathy? It's an idea in line with the so-called intense world theory, a newer way of thinking about the nature of autism. Specifically, the new idea being touted by Henry and Camilla Markram of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Europe. They focus on autism spectrum disorders as being based not in a social deficiency, but rather a hypersensitivity to experience, which includes an overwhelming fear response. So here on Connections, we wanted to reach out to our local community and ask, does this theory resonate? Is it missing something? What can we learn from it? And let me introduce our panel. Ann Cole is an advisor for Autism Up, and she has two children on the spectrum. I should say Autism Up is the local support organization for families who are facing the challenges of autism spectrum disorder. Ann, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Also here is Pat Muir, who is the head of Family Advocates United. That combines 9 different local organizations in advocacy for supports and services for families that have yet to receive them. And Pat has a son on the spectrum as well. Pat, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here. Julian Rue is here. He's a senior at Geneseo. Julian, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And a self-advocate as well. Nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Drew Richardson's here, a self-advocate and an administrative assistant at Autism Up as well. Drew, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
I'm going to start with Drew. We'll go back around the room, if you don't mind. You read the article and you heard about this notion. Why don't you tell me what you think about it? What resonates with you when we talk about the notion of not a lack of empathy, but maybe a hypersensitivity to emotion?
Well, I mean, we do have, you know, empathy. We do obviously feel and sympathize with, you know, a lot of emotional events. It's just that sometimes, since we lack reading social cues, we really don't know how to showcase those emotions in the way that most people would.
And let me follow up and ask you then, what is the biggest stereotype that you hear about Asperger's?
Well, sometimes that we can be, I guess, like, cold with our emotions. Like, for example, there was one time where I had a friend whose relative passed, and they were obviously visibly distraught, and when they broke the news to me, I just simply said, okay, because I wasn't sure how to react to the news. And, you know, most people, they would say, I'm sorry, but obviously me in that situation, I didn't know how to react, so I simply said, okay, and people viewed that as being non-empathetic and non-sympathetic to one's emotions.
Yeah, interesting. And now, with the passage of time, I'm laughing because Drew just exhaled. Drew, I'm enthralled with that point because you have this tremendous self-awareness about it. And obviously, with the passage of time, you're able to look back and say, okay, now I understand why they thought I was being cold, but you didn't mean to. I mean, do you remember internally what your emotional response
was? Yeah, internally I was obviously, you know, just as upset as they were. Mm-hmm. But it's just, again, you don't know how to convey that across with your emotions and showcasing that to other people.
Yeah, oh, wow. Julian Rue, same kind of question for you then. Let me ask you, what is the biggest stereotype that you encounter?
I would say that biggest stereotype that I encounter is that, you know, like, that people with autism are too trusting or they're so hyper-focused on one thing and everything. For example, all my closest friends know this, and everyone's going to roll their eyes when I say this, but I am a poker player and I do play for money. A lot of people think that that's all that I talk about, but I also am passionate about swimming and this Adult Connections group, as well as a lot of advocacy for people with disabilities. And so, like, that's one stereotype. And another thing that you know, that, you know, like Drew said, that people will see him as cold and everything. And for me, like, in a conversation, like, I like to tell things as they are so that people get the message. And so when I tell people how I feel about a situation and things like that, I don't like to sugarcoat anything and walk on eggshells with people. I like to tell it as it is. Mm-hmm. And if people don't like it, then that's too bad. That's not me being cold. That's just me being honest. And I think that's the honesty part with, you know, that people with autism have.
So the notion that you would be too blunt at times, but that's just part of who you are.
I wouldn't say blunt. It's just all brutal honesty. And yes, I can be blunt. I mean, I'll be humble about that. I'm not perfect, obviously, but yeah, pretty much.
Well, if you were perfect, you'd be the first one that I've met if it was perfect.
Perfection is an illusion, my friend.
There you go. Julian, when you read the article, did you agree with the idea that we stereotype autism in a way that makes us think that it lacks empathy and instead it can be that difficulty in processing that hypersensitivity to emotion?
Well, I mean, so the stereotype is somewhat true, I think. And I sent that in an email, you know, before the show. I don't think all people with autism lack empathy. For example, I sometimes may feel too much empathy, but it's at this point, it's not that all the time. It's that I have so much sensory stimuli around me. The sound, the sight of the sun that came in, and the lights and everything. I get emotional sometimes because of all the sensory stimuli and everything. It's not that I over-empathize or anything or consider people's feelings too much. So, yeah.
Okay. Let me turn to Ann and Pat. Pat, what do you think? Again, you read the piece. I know you've had family experience in this. And so does it resonate with you?
Absolutely. My son has autism. He doesn't have Asperger's. But I think a lot of it is also the fact that individuals with autism need more time to process what they hear and what they experience before they can take action. And so it isn't necessarily that he lacks empathy, it's that it takes him a little while to absorb that information and react to it. I know that a lot of times people think that he's not aware of what's going on, when the reality is that it's just simply taking him a little longer and that reaction will come later.
Exactly what we just heard from Drew. And in fact, the first great lesson that I'm trying to soak in this hour is, because there are plenty of people, friends in my life and relatives, people with either autism or Asperger's syndrome. And it's a good reminder for me not to overreact to whatever their reaction is to either news of an event or a moment, to allow for more time, to not just make a decision about someone's character or someone's, you know, personality just based on that moment. That this is about making sure that there's time to process and absorb, and that we're all different and sometimes people need that time.
Absolutely. And not to be surprised when that reaction comes a little bit later. I think, you know, that people think maybe by the time the reaction comes that the person should have moved on from processing that information. And instead, it's like it's brand new, maybe a half an hour, maybe a day later.
Ann Cole, what do you think?
I totally concur with that. I have done a training for Busse's Transportation, and I think this story will probably highlight that same thing with the processing. A lot of our individuals with autism who are on the bus get upset on the bus because a routine isn't followed and they're not quite sure what happened. For instance, a bus may not go pick up a student, but the student with the autism who's on the bus realizes that somebody has not been picked up. So they're upset because that routine has been followed, and they're trying to get the bus driver's attention to let them know that somebody wasn't picked up. And it may not even be that same day that it comes up. It could be processed and come up another day.
And again, as a parent, we've been talking about those stereotypes. What hurts you as a parent?
What hurts me as a parent?
What's difficult as
with the stereotypes that are bestowed on my children? My children are amazing. They are both so individual, and I think even as we talk about this situation with empathy and autism, we have to remember that everybody is different, and they all have their own different levels of empathy, just like anybody who was not on the spectrum. Everybody is completely different. So if you are, if you looked at two different adults who did not have autism, would they have different levels of being able to empathize? Yes. It would be a resounding yes. And that would be the same thing with individuals who are on the spectrum.
Yeah. Same question for you, Pat. What, as a parent, what can be the most difficult?
I think it's watching my son judge himself for the challenges that he has. He takes everything to heart. He struggles with communication and he struggles with behavior sometimes. And if he should fall down in his expectations of himself, he will absolutely become heartbroken. He will sob and weep. I mean, it would break your heart. And, you know, people get angry when an individual who is an adult loses control of their emotions and acts out. He can't help it in that moment. He struggles so hard to hold it together. And when you see how heartbroken he is at knowing that he has, you know, fallen down, last week he had a tough day. And 3 days later at his home, there was a plumbing issue. And they asked all the individuals who had family in the area to go home to their family's home because they had no water in the house. And he interpreted that as being sent away because he'd been bad 3 days earlier. It's very, very painful to watch him feel bad about something that is not in his control. And to see people who don't understand that is very difficult.
And for you as a parent, I imagine one of the first instincts is to say, you know, it's okay. It's okay. But that we know, obviously, not only doesn't always work, it can be entirely ineffective. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, we have to sort of accept that. And then the question becomes, when it comes to empathy and understanding about that hypersensitivity of emotion, do you accept it? Can it be modified? Do we want to modify it? What do you think, Pat?
I find what really helps the most with Nathan is to give him as much information about any experience that I can, in terms not only of what's going to happen, what information, sensory information might be coming in, what other people might be feeling, how he might feel, what his reaction could be, what could be a good choice, to prepare him as much as possible for every eventuality. You know, it's a lot of work, but it really helps him to feel more in control. And I think, you know, as he practices that, he gets better and better at it.
And? This is one of the things that Autism Up is really striving to push for, is that we have more social skills education being available to our families. We bring in national speakers such as Michelle Garcia Winner, who is social thinking, to help our professionals learn better skills to work with our individuals in schools. We've brought in Brenda Smith Miles with the Hidden Curriculum. These are social skills that typically we take for granted that people will know, but not necessarily everybody does. And if our schools are waiting for something to happen to teach the skill afterwards, they've already failed. We should be teaching these skills ahead of time. So in a situation, for instance, with Drew, how do you react when somebody has faced a death? What is a typical good way to respond? And practicing some of these social skills so when the actual event happens, they're in a better place.
I'm going to get to some comments from our audience in a moment. And if you want to join the conversation, you can. We'd love to hear from you as we talk about autism, Asperger's, empathy, and these various ideas on the program this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And on that question, and I think our parents in the room have especially made sure that we stay focused on the fact that not only is every person different, two people with Asperger's will be different, and Asperger's is different than autism. We're talking about, it's not apples to anvils, but it's not mm-hmm. always apples to apples. So I appreciate that. But let me ask Drew and Julian. Drew, when we talk about understanding, and let's say you and I are friends for years, and all of a sudden I have someone pass away just like your friend did, and I get that response. I hope your friends give you that space now. Have you developed that understanding that, do they give you more space to react emotionally or more time, as opposed to saying, hey, how come you didn't react more appropriately right at that moment and getting upset with you?
No, I don't really think so.
Okay, so it can be a struggle at times. Okay, so do you, when we talk about sort of, I don't know, whether we want to change or whether we want to modify behavior, Are you better at sort of understanding your own responses to events as you've gotten older? Are you better
now?
Yeah,
I mean, as I get older, you know, I'm certainly become more aware, obviously, of my feelings, but how to showcase those feelings towards others. You know, obviously, it was a struggle when I was younger, but as, you know, I get older, you know, I learn more and more as time goes by, and that certainly does help.
I would hope that if you have a conversation with a friend and you say, you know, I'm sorry you didn't, you saw my reaction at that moment, but understand this about me. I would hope that your friends, your family, whoever it is in your life would give you that space. I mean, that would be something that we can all improve upon, right? I'm not mm-hmm. talking about just you. I'm talking about all of us getting better at dealing with this, right?
Yes.
And Julian, the same kind of thing. As you've gotten a little older and you're a wise old college student now. So you're not old, but you've gotten older. Are you better at sort of gauging your own reaction and understanding where it's coming from?
I think it's just more like not overthinking situations and things. Like, for example, you know, if I get into a conflict or something like that, you know, with friends that we have a misunderstanding on something, I'm better able now to tell them how I'm feeling about something. And this is how I feel when you say something. Whereas like back in high school and middle school, I would react more inappropriately and I would articulate my feelings, but not in the best way. But I'm definitely more aware of how sensitive my emotional reactions are. And I can honestly tell you that I do feel a difference now. And knowing how I react to things, that's really the big key, is just that self-awareness.
How long has it been since a diagnosis for you, Julian?
It's been since 2.5 years. I'm 2.5 years old. I mean, during that time, I got early intervention, and that really was key for me to help me succeed in school.
That's a great point. When we talk on this program about early intervention on a myriad of subjects, that's a great endorsement for exactly what we're talking about. 2.5 is very different. I know someone who got the diagnosis at the age of 26.
And yet, look at the number of services that are being cut for early intervention. Mm. So pay now or pay later?
Well, we'll get to that in a moment. Ann knows exactly where we want to take part of this conversation. Drew, for you, when was the diagnosis?
I was actually diagnosed at the age of 4. I was originally diagnosed with PDD-NOS, but that was later upgraded.
What's that?
It's pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. And later, the diagnosis was, I guess, quote-unquote, upgraded to Asperger's once the DSM-4 came out in 94.
Okay. So since 4 years old?
Yeah.
And it's hard to know the answer to this, but have you thought about at least the benefits in your own life from at least getting that diagnosis as a young child versus as an adult? You know, certainly the assumption is it's got to be much more advantageous for you, for your family. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about that, what that difference would be?
Yeah, well, I mean, on one hand, it's like when my family received the diagnosis, it was sort of like, it was sort of a relief in a way, because mm-hmm. they knew, okay, we finally have answers as to what's occurring with her son. So it was a relief for my parents to realize, okay, we have a diagnosis, now we have advantages to see what we can do to help him throughout life.
I think it's a great point.
Drew, you should talk about what you're also doing with your advanced education now.
Yes, I'm going to school for a degree in social work.
And is there a reason that you are drawn to that field?
Yes, well, I mean, I feel like I want to, you know, give back to the community, you know, pay it forward. You know, I obviously, you know, I did receive a lot of help through my educational years, and I want to be there to help others along the way.
And Julian, what are you doing, by the
way? How about that for empathy?
No, that's amazing. That's a great point. Exactly. And Julian, you're studying what?
I'm studying communication on the personal professional track. That's more like the public relations advertising track at SUNY Geneseo, which, you know, also I'm interning here at WXXI this semester. So, mm-hmm.
A little shout out to your employer. That's fine. On that note, you know, you're in communications. Another stereotype I hear about people with autism or Asperger's is that they're almost uniformly introverts, that they'd rather be alone, not dealing with other people. And I hear varying things. So let me ask you, Julian, you're in communications. You seem pretty gregarious to me. Is it different for everybody? And do you hear that stereotype as well?
Here's where people get personality wrong is is that, you know, like people think that also people get introverts wrong. People think that introverts are always these quiet people. And while there are those people, I mean, you look at me, very gregarious and everything. I'm an introvert as well. Whereas, you know, you'll find people that are very quiet, very chill, but they're very extrovert. They get energized. And going back to that autism subject, I have a friend, Etsuna Geneseo from Long Island, who he has Asperger's, but he's very extroverted and he always hangs out with people and he gets energized by that interaction. So it's not all people with autism are extroverted. Introverted. I have autism and I happen to be introverted. And I think that's where the language needs to be at.
He makes a very important point, which is he used the word energy. We had a conversation about a year ago with a professor at Hobart and William Smith who did research on introverts and extroverts, especially in the classroom setting. But it's not just about shy. That's a word that's sort of incorrectly thrown around. It's about where do you get your energy? Are you more energized, you know, doing something, reading a book on a couch by yourself with a warm mug of coffee or doing something on your own? Or are you more energized in a group setting? That's the first easy way to kind of start to differentiate. So as much as I meet Julian and we're having a great time talking and we're laughing, he may not identify himself as someone who gets energy from those situations as opposed to, you know, the more solo activities. So, Drew, for you, do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert? And do you think there is a stereotype there with autism and Asperger's?
Well, I was an introvert when I was younger, and I really chalked that up to the fact that as I lacked the social skills and reading the social cues, I felt overwhelmed if I would go out in public, thus the result of me wanting to always stay home by myself. Obviously, as I've gotten older, you know, I've become more, you know, well off with reading social cues and, you know, the social skills. So, yeah, I would say I am more extroverted now.
Interesting. And that is a fascinating progression. Pat, what have you witnessed? That's fascinating to me.
Well, I think that you and Drew make a good point in that for some people with autism, it's work to try to interact with other people. And so it's not energizing. It is draining for them.
Interesting.
So I think that's often the difference.
Yeah. So in that construction, we realize that if people with autism or Asperger's tend to be more introverted as a general population, maybe that's true. And maybe that comes from just the energy you have to exert just to read the cues, sort of get in tune with what people's reactions are. And sometimes it's easier just to say, I'll be on my own for it. But it's not because you don't care about others or you don't care about their experiences. I mean, this is an important distinction, I think, Anne.
I really believe that. I really do believe that. I have two teens who are on the spectrum, a boy and a girl, and they are complete opposites in that respect. I have a son who, if we look at the energy-wise answering the question, he is an extrovert. And if you look at my daughter, she is an introvert. It's just too much work for her to be around a whole lot of people and processing the language and learning how to answer questions back and showing the social ineptness that she's supposed to show in these situations. It's much easier for her to be a one-on-one situation or on her own.
All right, we've got to take a 60-second break, and when we come back, I want to get to some of our audience feedback. I have a couple of written comments that have come in as well. People very tuned into this conversation about autism and autism spectrum. You can join the conversation by phone if you want. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. So right back with more on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about unmanned aircraft, small enough that you can pick them up with your hand. People often call them drones, small drones, the kind that crash-landed on the White House lawn this week. What are the new rules coming for drones? What should be and what should not be allowed? What about privacy concerns? Join the conversation on drones next hour on Connections.
C Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
Here we come back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and our panel is talking about a relatively new school of thought when it comes to autism and autism spectrum, which was recently kind of crystallized in a theory put out by a couple of researchers in Europe. Henry and Camilla Markram of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Europe have talked about what they think is an extension of the intense world theory, their idea that we misread people with autism when we assume that they do not care about others as much as someone without autism, or that they lack empathy, or that they lack emotion, and instead they are overstimulated and can be overwhelmed by emotion, which can cause, at least in certain moments, a kind of a shutdown that we would perceive as cold or distant, and instead it's a difficulty in processing emotion. Obviously, if that's on the money, then we are responding probably inappropriately to people around us all the time, and that's what we're trying to do this hour, is get better at understanding all of our differences and what they mean. So Ann Cole's here. She's an advisor for Autism Up and has two children on the spectrum. Pat Muir from Family Advocates United and has a son on the spectrum. Drew Richardson and Julian Rue are here. They're self-advocates. Julian's a senior at Geneseo. Drew is an administrative assistant to Autism Up. And I want to read a comment that came from a listener who asked to have their name left out. And here's the comment. This show doesn't just resonate with me. It is screaming my name, and I've been familiar with many of these concepts for a long time. Not being clinically diagnosed, I've had serious issues bringing these topics up with family and friends because I've always just been looked at as a, quote, odd one, and the possibility of being on the spectrum is seen as, quote, silly, primarily because I've managed, relatively speaking, relatively well to keep the worst of the personal effects under control or well hidden. I don't think a clinical diagnosis is relevant for me, but what would your guests say to a person such as myself? By the way, I'm 37 years old.
Autism Up runs a program called Adult Connections. I would invite you to come to our Adult Connections meeting. We meet once a month on the third Wednesday, and you can find information in our website under support for connections groups. It's at autismup.org. It's one word, AUTISMUP.org. Come in, talk to us. Autism Up is not just for those with a diagnosis. It is also for those with a suspected diagnosis. Or if you're feeling you need some extra support and understanding because of some of the same learning characteristics are yours, I think we might have some ideas for you.
When this listener said they don't think a diagnosis would be relevant for them in their adult life, what do you think, Ann?
There are a lot of discussions in our Adult Connections groups of those who already have a diagnosis and those that don't. And unfortunately, with autism, there's a huge gap with finding supports and services. There is the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities. So if there is an intellectual impairment, you can get some supports and services through that government agency. A lot of times, 66% of the time, somebody with autism does not have an intellectual disability. And those are the ones that are struggling with finding supports and services. Access VR used to be VESID, and they provide vocational support for anybody who has a disability. And it's not necessarily just autism, but any kind of a disability. So some of our families are able to find some supports through Access VR. But again, there's a lot of gaps and holes. There aren't enough job coaches. There aren't enough employers that are offering opportunities for internships or experiences for these individuals. And people with autism can make fabulous employees, but we need opportunity.
Pat?
I would say it's up to the person whether they feel that getting a diagnosis is relevant for them, but certainly getting support, whether through a psychologist who's familiar with the spectrum, might help them to have that conversation with their family about what accommodations they might need and just maybe the differences that they might be seeing in that person. I would hate to think that I think my brother was on the spectrum and he never got a diagnosis. And I think that he struggled a lot in his life. And probably having a nephew with autism was a big help because he learned a lot by what we went through. And there are so many supports and things out there now that were not available before. I would hate to see somebody miss out and struggle when they didn't have to.
That's well said. Again, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Ben wants to know what an autism diagnosis entails. You know, so what's the process? I don't know if Ben is following up on the previous listener's comment, but let's say you're 37, let's say you're 27 or 17 or 7. What is the process of making a diagnosis?
Part of it has to do with your age. If you are diagnosed early on, you can receive, and especially, again, if that intellectual impairment is present, mm-hmm. you can receive OPWD services, Office of People with Developmental Disabilities services, up to age 8, where you have to go through a re-diagnosis anyway. For autism, it is supposed to be a developmental disability that is lifelong. So it shouldn't be something that all of a sudden appears when you're 37. It should be something that's been there right along. So that should be an indicator. It's not something that just happened when you turned 37. The boys probably can talk more about what they went through, but there is developmental assessments that are done by not by a pediatric, not by a pediatrician, but by developmental pediatricians, specialized pediatricians. And some psychologists have the capacity to do it. It's not just done by your pediatrician. You are referred to these specialists for this diagnosis. And they look for certain things that are typically seen for somebody who's on the spectrum. And they have to have a core number of these deficits to qualify for a diagnosis. That's a real nutshell description.
And we had a listener who wanted to know if we are potentially over-diagnosing autism now.
That's been something that comes up a lot, especially when you see the numbers being diagnosed changing. I think
1 in 66 now? 1 in 68?
1 in 68.
1 in 68.
1 in 42 boys. So it's more diagnosed in boys than girls. I think that there have been changes in how it's diagnosed on the different diagnoses, the DSM-4, 5, the revised 4, the 3, the 2, the 1, as you've gone back through the years. But I also think more and more people are talking about autism, so there's more recognition that it might be something to look at as a disability when you're seeing quirkiness going on with your youngster. I think there is less stigma than there used to be. You know, I don't even want to bring up the name Rain Man because everybody goes, oh, yeah, that's what I used to think too. Well, hopefully that is what you used to think because
absolutely.
Such a huge different spectrum is obviously there.
And, you know, to Julian's point earlier about poker, he likes to play poker, but he doesn't want people to think, especially with a diagnosis with Asperger's, that that's the only interest and that's a hyper-focused interest. Even though my understanding is, yes, people with autism can be really keyed in on a particular interest, that kind of a thing. We would probably make it kind of a caricature if we assume that everyone just has one.
How many times have you heard, he can't have autism, look how smart he is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's really smart. That absolutely can still be on the spectrum. Here's two gentlemen sitting here right now who have Regents diplomas. They're very smart.
Actually, I should also share with our audience that the two gentlemen sitting here are much more technically proficient with the audio equipment in this room than I am as the host. They came in and were asking questions about the... What was the question you asked, Drew?
Yeah, I asked if this was a dynamic or a condenser mic.
And Val, do you want to answer that? Val's our engineer. I'm hoping she'll tell me if this is a dynamic or a condenser mic. I actually have no idea. She says it's a condenser mic. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Here? Okay.
Well, that was my assumption. So.
It makes no sense to me, but...
And Julian was talking about the microphone popping.
Yeah, popping peas, which basically what that is radio-wise, I learned from a very, very good professor at SUNY Geneseo, is that like this pop filter that I'm talking into right here, that prevents me saying a word that has the letter P in it too much of like a popping sound. So it softens it a little bit.
Yeah, look what we're all learning. Let me get to the phones and If you're just joining us, we're having a great conversation about the nature of autism, of Asperger's, and what we all can do to sort of understand one another better. This is Beverly in Rochester. Go ahead, Beverly. Beverly, are you there? Hold on 1 second, Beverly. If you're there, I can't hear you, but I bet you I'll hear you. Beverly,
I'm... Scientific American Mind.
Beverly, I'm sorry, only because we couldn't hear your audio at the start. Start over and right. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. I happened to get a free copy today of a magazine. It's called Scientific American Mind. And it's a January issue for 2015. And there's an article in here called Autism Grows Up. New programs are helping ease the transition to adulthood for people on the spectrum. And it looks like a wonderful article on the topic. Anybody, I encourage you to try to find this magazine, Scientific American Mind.
Scientific American. Beverly, thanks for the call. Have you guys seen the article? It sounds like it's brand new.
I've seen the publication. Mm-hmm. I have not seen that specific article.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the tip, Beverly, and just another sort of interesting piece of literature to look for. This is Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, go ahead.
Hi. As I listen to this, I hear a lot is going in, a lot of effort is being done in teaching or getting autistic people to deal with society. But my question is, how good is our society in terms of dealing with different people? And again, I don't like calling autism or anything disability, but is our society becoming more open to this kind of difference, or is that a problem? Should we have more classes in our schools on how to deal with different people, regardless of, you know, whether you can, you know, diagnose it or not? Anyway, I appreciate your comments.
Bernard, thanks for the call.
Well, this is Julian talking in again. I'm just going to tell you that I don't think we need more classes specifically making understanding people with autism or other developmental disabilities as a topic, but I think we do need more awareness by having speakers come in to schools and everything and do that early on, because what I found was rare once in a while, like there'll be a case coordinator come in saying, oh, yes, here's why Julian's reacting this way, but what they do not get to the core of is symptoms of autism and everything, and why you might see in general certain people acting this way, whether they have ADHD or whatever, and they should consistently do that throughout elementary school, middle school, and everything. So, but thankfully, I think our society also is becoming more open to accepting those who are quote unquote different, such as people with autism. But otherwise, I think that I think that there should be more talk on this, but I don't think we need classes to do that. It has to start when you're very, 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 very young to start to be taught that understanding.
Drew?
Well, I've noticed that, you know, I've had my diagnosis since the age of 4, so I've had it for nearly, 23, 24 years. But I've noticed certainly as time has gone on, you know, when I was diagnosed, we really didn't have that many organizations that, you know, were advocating and raised awareness. And, you know, obviously now in 2015, we have a multitude of organizations, you know, Autism Up, they've done so much in the past 10 years. And I think as a society, we are becoming more accepting of people who are, quote, different in terms of, you know, neurological differences. You know, obviously with awareness being raised, you know, I mean, I think, yes, some more education is necessary, but I think just as society goes on, we'll become more accepting of people.
Well, Drew makes the point that we're seeing more organizational structures, et cetera. But Anne, you said earlier that you're worried about resources. So is there a dissonance there? Do we see more opportunity for help and support services? And if that's the case, you know, what is the state of resources? You know, it does sound like there's a lot available.
That is the multi-million-dollar question, the state of resources, which it seems to be in constant flux because we have a changing system with how services are going. For instance, and Pat can talk about this if she wants to, in terms of finding a place to live when you have an adult who needs supports and services. There's a wait list in New York State, 12,000 people waiting for a place to live. That's a huge hole in services. There's something missing. And as the system continues to change, more and more pressure is put on a family to take care of it themselves. Find connections in your own community. Find your own way to support your individual who has an autism spectrum disorder. That's tough, because what if your caregiver is already 60 or 65? They want to make sure that their loved one is safe and taken care of when something happens to them.
Yes, Anne makes an excellent point. The state wants individuals with autism and every disability to be included and to be living in the community, to be employed, and that's a wonderful goal, but we need resources to fund those services that make it possible for people to do that. The state has continually cut the budget to the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities since 2008. So we are seeing an increase in the number of people who need services at the same time that budgets are decreasing. And we are asking the community to open its doors and let people in. And I think the community as a whole generally wants to do that and wants to include people of all abilities, but they need help and support to be able to do that. You know, we need job coaching. We need residential supports. We need people to be taught how to live independently in their own homes. Not every person with an autism spectrum disorder is as able as Drew and Julian are, and so they need some specific training, and those services cost money. And they're not services that are typically being provided in school. They are often adult services. So we need to, our organization, Family Advocates United, is focused specifically on advocating for the funding for those services.
How are schools, how are public schools in either integrating or making sure they're working effectively with kids with autism?
Well, that could be a whole nother show.
That's a whole other topic.
That's a whole nother topic. There are varying degrees.
I was going to say, there's probably not one answer on this, is there?
There's not one answer. And you can talk to one family and say they're doing a great job, and you can talk to another family and saying it's not working at all. They're really, they're providing a disservice for our kids.
Can I ask Drew and Julian? Drew, I'll start with you. where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up here in Rochester.
Okay. And school experience for you through high school, how was it?
It was good. I mean, I started having academic troubles in right around middle school, and I attended the START program at the Monroe One BOCES. I guess it's now been renamed the O'Connor Academy, but that certainly did help me with my schooling. It provided I believe it was a 7-to-1-1 ratio, in which, you know, normally 7 students to 1 teacher plus a paraeducator, and it provided rigorous education per se, but it provided, you know, the additional support for students who needed a little extra help going through school.
Okay. Julian, how was your experience?
I mean, I could talk a million years about this, but I'll try to make a long story short as possible for you. Starting from when I went to the Park School down in Ossining, New York, which is in Westchester County, really funding for services down there in those schools at the time was so much more generous than up here. I mean, you had more services down there. I started having collaborative classes where I would be in a special ed class in the morning, kindergarten and first grade, and then I would go into a mainstream class. So I was gradually transitioning into a mainstream type of environment. Now, when I moved up here, my mom really had a fight for services for me, because I went to school, I'm not going to name the district, obviously, but I mean, they didn't really provide enough services for me, other than like a 1-to-1 aid. But as my mom really fought and advocated for services, I gradually had more of the 1-to-1 aids and everything, and the special ed courses, the resource and everything. And really, thanks to that, I really excelled, and I graduated from high school as of like 4 or 5 years ago, and here I am talking on connections. So.
Yeah, it certainly has worked out well for you, and I think to Anne's point, I have heard a wide range of experiences from families. Pat, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I wanted to let you know, Evan, that in the next 3 years in the western region of New York State, more than 3,000 folks will graduate with IEP diplomas. That's an Individualized Education Plan diploma, which basically means that folks have completed 21 years of education. There isn't you know, a course of study that is completed for that diploma, half of those individuals are not ready to be working in a competitive environment. And so those folks need to have adult services, and we don't have a plan to provide for those folks. That's a big concern going forward, that, you know, folks are leaving school without the services necessary for the next step.
What's one way to fix it?
Advocate. Our organization, we work with 9 local organizations that have family advocacy components. We have a Facebook page. It's called Still Waiting, Family Advocates United. You can connect with us there. Our local legislators are wonderful. They support us, and they really understand the need out there. But on a statewide basis, unfortunately, the governor very often vetoes bills that will help our families. So we have to convince the governor that our folks need additional services.
I just wanted to also say that, again, we're in flux with even the graduation requirements. Where it used to be an IEP diploma, they're now giving credentials that a CDOS or a skills achievement credential, but it's still not a diploma. So if you've got an individual who has the ability to be working, they're still walking out of school without a diploma.
I don't know why every time in the last year we've talked about autism on this program we get this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Rachel wants to know if the Seinfeld thing helped or hurt. And I think she's referring to the fact that Jerry Seinfeld said that he thinks he might be on the spectrum. And that I
heard Dan Aykroyd. And...
Oh, I hadn't heard that. But does that kind of thing, does that diminish the seriousness? Or does that say, okay, you know, let's remind ourselves that it's a broad spectrum, that it is that we're understanding more about it.
Well, if it's 1 in 68, it's 1 in 68 celebrities too. They're out there. They're just coming to light.
Pat?
I think that's true, and you know, he knows his experience of growing up, and he may have risen to the top of his profession. But he may still have had the same experience growing up of feeling like he didn't fit in, he didn't understand why people acted the way they did, how he should respond. So it's entirely possible that he could be on the spectrum. I don't know whether it helps or hurts when you look at someone who is that high achieving, and maybe that now becomes the new stereotype of autism, that everybody should be able to live on their own.
I'm not even sure, Julian and Drew, do you know who Jerry Seinfeld? I hope you do.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course.
Well, I mean, you know, I make assumptions sometimes. Julian, you wanted to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I was really going to answer that passionately. I mean, I'm not going to speculate things that are not true. However, you know, what people have to realize about saying that, hey, I think I might have Asperger's is, and many people have said this, I'm not going to say an original point or anything, but when you say to people, hey, I think I have Asperger's, you got to realize that, oh, you're not just becoming another person who finally realizes his or her diagnosis. You're joining a community of people that have autism, as well as people that passionately advocate for services for those with autism and other people with disabilities. So you're really joining another community. So obviously, I'm not going to criticize Jerry Seinfeld. I love the man to death, but he knows his story. Pat pretty much said most of everything, but the only thing that I would say is, you know, when you do that type of thing where you think you have that, just be careful of, you know, the impact of realizing you have that diagnosis. I mean, it's mostly positive, but you just got to have that awareness.
Well said. Well, let me begin to wrap the conversation by saying that if you missed any part of it, not only do we podcast it, but we'll also make sure that I post on our Twitter page, at Evan Dawson, the article that sort of sparked my interest in this, and you'll find it there. I'll put it up on Twitter later this afternoon. It's about whether individuals with Asperger's syndrome don't lack empathy. In fact, they empathize too much, and that our stereotypes are perilous, and we probably should rethink some of those stereotypes, which is probably always a good idea. So that article will be posted later today. Some quick thoughts here, and in terms of resources, where you would send people again, Autism Up is an organization that does what?
Well, I'm going to start with Kirsch. If you have a young child and you think that there may be an issue, even if it's not autism, but think there may be a developmental disability going on, go and see someone at Kirsch. You can look up the telephone number or...
Spell Kirsch.
K-I-R-C-H, and it's part of Strong, go and seek that diagnosis of some sort, but don't wait, because if you are waiting on getting some very important services started, that could be really beneficial for the lifetime of that child.
You heard Drew say earlier this hour, at the age of four, that in many ways, for that family, there was relief.
Absolutely. And then secondly, connect with Autism Up, even if you suspect it, and get some more information. Because even the families who have gotten the diagnosis are turned into robots trying to find more information. Come and get some help.
Ann Cole advises Autism Up. Thank you for taking the time today, Ann.
Glad to be here.
Pat Muir with Family Advocates United. Again, it's still waiting, Family Advocates United on Facebook. You'll learn a lot more about those services. Thanks for taking the time, Pat. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Drew Richardson, not only an administrative assistant at Autism Up, but sharing his impressive story. Drew, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Evan.
And Julian Rue, I'll see you here at WXXI.
Great to be here. I'll be here tomorrow.
He's going to be here tomorrow. Thanks for taking the time as well. Great to talk to all of you. Short break, and we turn our attention to the question of drones next hour on Connections.
Thank you.